From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Hip checks in Washington this week, world pushback all over, violence, some laughter. Benazir Bhutto returned to Pakistan after an eight-year exile. She was greeted by cheering crowds and deadly bombs. Listen for the blast. In Senate hearings, Attorney General nominee Michael Mukasey was careful with his ifs as he addressed interrogation and torture.
I don't know what's involved in the technique. If waterboarding is torture, torture is not constitutional.
And Senator Barack Obama talked about a revelation that he may be a distant cousin of Vice President Dick Cheney. Here he is on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno.
The truth is, I am okay with it. Yeah, now, you know, I don't want to be invited to the family hunting party.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable, goes behind the week's headlines. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week, from surveillance to Mukasey to Turkey and the Middle East? Is the U.S. still leading? Is the world still following? Joining me today in the studio is Glenn Kessler, diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. His big new book, The Confidant, Condoleezza Rice and the Creation of the Bush Legacy, is just out and could not be more timely. Glenn, welcome. Welcome back to On Point.
Glad to be with you.
Great to have you. Joining us from Washington is Margaret Tolliv, national political correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, which include the Miami Herald, Sacramento Bee, Kansas City Star, Charlotte Observer, and on. She's been in Iowa this week and following the candidates. Margaret, great to have you. Welcome back.
Hello, Tom. Nice to talk to you.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst and senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Welcome, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Glenn, and Margaret.
Okay, we've got a lot on our plates here, but Glenn, let me just ask you right off the bat. I mean, pushback this week from Turkey, and it had an effect from China on the Dalai Lama, we don't know, on Russia, talking with the Caspian Sea crew and all that, pushing back on Iran and nukes and all the rest. It looked for a while here like the United States doesn't have many followers as it attempts to lead on several fronts.
Well, the United States is in a very difficult position right now, and particularly as this presidential term wanes in its final months. And you see Secretary Rice trying her best to put together a peace conference that will make some progress on the Middle East. But on many fronts, just before she went to the Middle East, she was kind of pushed back by Putin on the missile defense initiative.
Left waiting with Secretary Gates outside his place for 45 minutes and then lectured in the lawn.
That's exactly right. And then he flew off to Tehran, where he was very cozy with the Iranian leader there.
Big push in Congress for an Armenian genocide resolution. That appears to be going by the by. At the Pentagon yesterday, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates reiterated his position that the U.S. must keep up good relations with Turkey, should not pass a bill labeling the killing of Armenians during World War I a genocide. That bill now appears to be shelved.
It has the potential to do real harm to our troops in Iraq and would strain, perhaps beyond repair, our relationship with a key ally in a vital region and in the wider war on terror.
Margaret Tolliv, Turkey pushed back hard. The House appears to be blinking. What's going on here?
Well, many of Ms. Pelosi's closest advisors and the smartest Democratic strategists on the House side also think that politically this would be a bad idea to go forward. So I think the question is, why did Speaker Pelosi and the other Democrats want it? Was it on principle, or was it because, hey, they didn't mind, you know, messing with the president, the way the president is poised in terms of Turkey and Iraq?
So,
but I agree. No, I think it's not going anywhere right now.
Not going anywhere right now, and that may mean not for a long time. Of course, before the Senate this week, Attorney General nominee Michael Mukasey on the big issue of torture. Here's Senator Alan Spector, Republican of Pennsylvania, with Mukasey.
The president can't authorize torture because torture is barred both by statute and by the Constitution. And I'd be happy to walk back through that if you wish.
Well, where in the Constitution is torture barred?
It's barred by the 5th, the 14th, and the 8th Amendments. The 5th and the 14th Amendments bar conduct that shocks the conscience. They've been so interpreted.
Well, Glenn Kessler, is the we'll talk about Congress, but is the world buying that, that the U.S. is not going to be part of conduct that shocks the conscience?
No, not at all. This has been a very troublesome issue for the Bush administration, and in fact, the revelations that the CIA had secret prisons in several European countries sent shockwaves through Europe and caused real problems when Secretary Rice traveled through there in 2005. The problem is that the administration has played semantic games with this, where they will say, as a matter of policy, we don't do this. And they don't – that's a weasel word that lets you get away with with saying, well, as a matter of policy, but
– when the chips are down.
Yeah. We'll do what we want. And it's been clearly documented that the CIA has used these enhanced interrogation techniques, such as waterboarding, which many human rights people would say is akin to torture. And, in fact, in the State Department human rights reports, that's often cited as aggressive techniques that countries shouldn't do.
And was out of bounds for this country's military for many, many years. Margaret Tolov, torture is just one of the issues on any attorney general's plate. What do you make of the congressional reception, the Senate reception of Mukasey this week?
Well, what a difference a day makes, right? On day one, it was a love fest. And yesterday morning, talking to your producer, I said, oh, he's a slam dunk. This will be over within a few days. And then, you know, then come the second wave of hearings. But what I would deduce from yesterday's hearings is that he's probably going to be confirmed anyhow. But no one's going to be feeling as great about it as they were before. And that the U.S. probably is waterboarding some people, or he wouldn't have worded things as carefully as he did.
Jack Beatty, here we are, Congress considering at home after a very tough, rough, unhappy time with Alberto Gonzalez. We've got a new attorney general sitting there, and still U.S. policy in the world left into kind of a murky quadrant. Maybe U.S. policy at home as well. Surveillance was very much on the table this week. What do you see in it, Jack?
Well, you know, as to the effect of our torture, our waterboarding, our harsh treatment, whatever you want to call it, in the world, a BBC survey released this year of more than 26,000 people in 25 different countries found that 7 out of 10 people disapprove of what we're doing at Guantanamo, and half of those people in the sample thought that the United States plays a mostly negative role in the world. Now, that says that any gain we could be getting from these detainees through these methods is so far outweighed by the effect as to make that gain nugatory. But in fact, there is no gain. The New Republic reports this week, talking to CIA people and FBI people, who say one man says never got anything of particular value out of Guantanamo. Another one says I don't recall any information coming out of Guantanamo that was helpful. And these people had actually got information out of people through legal methods. So, in other words, it's not even working in the narrow sense and failing catastrophically in this war, really, which is an ideological war for hearts and minds in the Muslim world and beyond.
And now we're lectured by Vladimir Putin. Margaret Tallett, take us back to Capitol Hill for a minute here. Movement this week on S-CHIP, the children's health bill that's gone back and forth. The president's veto there will stand. And also on surveillance, what's happened?
Well, on surveillance, what's happening is that the updated FISA bill is moving through the process, but it's getting bumpy. What the Senate Intelligence Committee passed out last night is facing several negative reactions from Democrats already. There's a hold being threatened. There's new language in there affecting how Americans overseas can be surveilled. There's some problems with this, and it looked a couple days ago like Democrats were just going to say, okay, we'll give the phone companies some limited immunity, let's get this over with.
From whatever they may have done in the past, but what about now? Are they still headed to do that? Are they satisfied that boosting the FISA court's oversight here will sort of cover their bases on keeping track of what's going on? Or is there still enough resistance? This may not be a deal.
Something will be a deal, but I'm not sure if exactly this will be a deal. And I think part of it is that there is a legitimate, you need to have a law in place, and the Democrats and the Republicans both recognize that. Part of that is that technology has changed, and even Democrats who are coming from a real political perspective on this understand that, and they know they need to make some accommodations. But the problem is that there's so much secrecy about this that phone companies aren't being forthcoming at all. I mean, we don't, the details of what it is that they're particularly seeking immunity on aren't known. And there's a leap of faith and a trust issue also, which is that with a classified program, even if there's a law in place, people want to have a comfort level with what's really going on, because most of this is not going to be disclosed, and there is none of that comfort level now. So it's very murky precisely what it is that's going to pass. Something is going to pass, though. And I think part of that is that, God forbid there were another attack, right, between now and next year's election. Mm-hmm. Democrats don't want to feel that they're responsible for that because they, you know,
left the country exposed.
Mm-hmm. Legislation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. As far as SCHIP goes, sorry, though, if you want to talk about that now, the Democrats are taking this and running with it as a political issue, but as a legislative issue, they haven't gained any ground on this. And I think they were surprised at how the vote went yesterday.
We're looking at a week in the news. Bhutto survives bombs. The S-chip veto stands. Attorney General nominee Mukasey says plays hard to get on torture. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? What's moving your world? Was Congress right to fold on Armenian genocide? If it was wrong to cross Turkey, is it right to cross China on the Dalai Lama and Tibet? And is anybody following the U.S. lead in the world anymore? Turkey, Russia, China, the Caspian states all thumbing their noses this week. Glenn Kessler joins me in the studio, diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post, with his big new book on Condoleezza Rice, and we'll talk about it, The Confidant, Condoleezza Rice and the Creation of the Bush Legacy. Margaret Tollive with McClatchy Newspapers is here from Washington, Jack Beatty as well. Let's take a call from Angela in New Haven, Connecticut. Angela, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that for me, the biggest story this week, the real man bites dog, is Christopher Dodd coming out and pledging to put a hold on that FISA bill. I mean, it's the 2006 election come to fruition, and if it gets out there, will have, I think, an impact on the 2008 election. This is exactly what Democratic primary voters have been looking for.
So are you pleased that Dodd is saying he'll throw himself in the way of that bill as it attempts to roll through?
It's what we put this Congress in for. It's exactly that kind of thing that people have been waiting for.
And what about Margaret Tollive's point that if the Democrats block it and there's some kind of attack, they'll take the blame and maybe hit at the polls?
They're going to take the blame either way, and I think that this is a smart move that recognizes that it's not as if the Republican Party has taken responsibility for 911. So, I mean, you have to do what's right, ultimately. And even if it turns out to be the wrong thing factually, I think that people will respect Democrats for at least making the effort to do what we clearly want them to do.
Angela, thanks very much for that. Jack Beatty, what do you make of the politics and the national security faces of the surveillance issue? The president continues to say we have to know if there are conversations, that may hold a menace to the country. We've got to listen.
Yeah, as I understand it, and I don't have complete information, Senator Dodd's one of his chief objections is to the immunity for the telecoms for illegally cooperating with the president's illegal request, at least at the time, to share information, wiretapping in short. There's a case now in the Ninth Circuit Court and the Ninth Circuit Court in California, the federal courts. Going into exactly how AT&T, I believe, cooperated, how far they cooperated. In other words, throwing some light on all of this. And this is going to be costly for the telecoms. And the New York Times last week ran a long piece about just how extensively the telecoms are lobbying on Capitol Hill, how much money they're putting around. Wired magazine reports the growth, rather dramatic, of campaign contributions to Senator Rockefeller, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, who has brokered this deal with Bush. It involves the usual suspects of lobbying and campaign contributions, and for a real reason, the telecoms know this could cost them a lot of money from people who feel that their privacy was violated.
Of course, national security is in there, too. Presumably, the government, we hope, we want to trust, turn to them for a reason. Let's go to Alan in Moline, Illinois. Alan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My point is on this discussion about torture is that this has gotten to be so distorted. I mean, it's so un-American. You know, we've institutionalized the Bush administration's, torture policy that it becomes part of the actual discussion about what is American. We have to get away from this. You know, when Bush is gone, this is going to be a bad chapter in our history. And I think we need to recognize that it is perverse in the American tradition, and we can't institutionalize it. We cannot have it as part of the fabric of American tradition and spirit.
Alan, let us take that. Margaret Tolliver, is it reasonable to expect Michael Mukasey to stand up in the Senate hearings and say, I'm going to define waterboarding and torture and draw a line for you senators right now that won't be crossed? Could we expect that?
No. I mean, that's not going to happen. And the fact of the matter is, President Bush is probably not going to put up a nominee for attorney general. Who would say that? And the other fact is that it's possibly unlikely that a Democratic president with a different worldview would put up a nominee for attorney general who would put, absolute commitments like that on record during confirmation hearing. But there are some shades of gray, and I think senators were legitimately surprised by the degree to which the nominee Mukasey put his sort of what they thought were modified positions out there yesterday compared with his first day out there, basically suggesting he didn't know what waterboarding was, so it was hard to say whether it was torture. I mean, that's,
It's pretty much all over the place. You want to learn about it, it's easy to do. Glenn Kessler, I want to get your take on this issue of U.S. Leadership and who's following these days, particularly in the Middle East. Let's listen to a few clips here from the president and from his Secretary of State, who you're writing about in your new book. First, here's President Bush at a press conference on Wednesday talking about World War III and the dangers presented by a nuclear-armed Iran.
We got a leader in Iran who has announced that he wants to destroy Israel. So I've told people that if you're interested in avoiding World War III, it seems like you ought to be interested in preventing them from having the knowledge necessary to make a nuclear weapon. And I take the threat of Iran with a nuclear weapon very seriously.
Iran at the east of the region. At the west of the region, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has been laying the groundwork for a big Middle East peace conference, perhaps next month. She spoke in Ramallah in the Palestinian territories earlier this week about the administration's effort.
The president has decided to make this one of the highest priorities of his administration and of his time in office. It means that he is absolutely serious about moving this issue forward and moving it as rapidly as possible to conclusion.
Glenn Kessler, there's the administration, there's the Secretary of State, you're writing about her. Does she have a handle on what's going on in this region anymore, or is she chasing the train? First of all, on the Middle East conference she wants to put together, does it look like it's going to happen? Will it go to the end that she wants? And how ambitious is that? She's often sounded as though, well, history will take the course it takes. What can we do?
Well, it's been a dramatic shift for this administration this year. And I write in my book that she sat down with her staff in January and tried to figure out where were the three places she could make a difference diplomatically. One of them was North Korea, one was Iran, and one was Middle East peace.
How's it going on those fronts?
Well, North Korea, they're moving ahead on a nuclear deal. Iran, she has not had much traction at all. And then in the case of the Middle East, she is putting together this peace conference. And in my book, I actually detail how she got to this point and the many mistakes she made as National Security Advisor and as Secretary of State, which led to a situation where the Palestinian Authority is on the shelf collapse and a militant group, Hamas, had won legislative elections, which is all the result of U.S. policy. What she's trying to do now is, in essence, pull a rabbit out of a hat and get the parties together and have the Israelis and Palestinians sign on the piece of paper, joint declaration that would lay out the way forward for peace negotiations.
Mm.
And if she accomplishes that, that would be seen as an achievement. Now, one of her faults is that she's very good at focusing at the task at hand, but very bad at implementation and follow-up. And for this to be a success, you need to really follow up and have substantive negotiations going forward.
I mean, I remember even what Donald Trump, you know, said the problem with Condoleezza Rice is she never comes home with a deal. She goes out in her tall black boots. She talks and talks, but she never has a deal. She never sort of gets it over the what? Sports analogy, goal line.
Well, I mean, part of the argument I make in my book is that she was one of the weakest national security advisors in U.S. history, and the mistakes she made in that job have colored the choices and opportunities she has as Secretary of State. And she's really trying to make up for lost time here. Getting that piece of paper would be seen as an achievement, because never before have the Israelis and Palestinians signed such a joint declaration. But that's just the first step. And I think even in her private moments, she would concede that you're not going to get a Palestinian state created on this administration's term.
There were moments this week, one in particular, where it almost seemed that she was saying, well, it's in the hands of a higher power. You know, gearing up for this, she visited Bethlehem on Wednesday. Of course, she's, the daughter and granddaughter of Presbyterian ministers. She was asked by reporters in Bethlehem about the meaning of visiting the birthplace of Jesus.
Personally, for me, a reminder that the Prince of Peace is still with us and still with me and with all of us.
Is that Condoleezza Rice in the George W. Bush style handing off to the big guy there, Glenn?
Well, she is very deeply, deeply religious. And she does have this attitude that a lot of things are in God's hands and that it allows her to actually keep going forward, because she thinks, you know, in the broad sweep of history, who knows whether or not what she's doing now will be looked at kindly or not so kindly, but it's out of her hands.
But is there a kind of fatalism in that puts a brake on accomplishment?
Well, what it does is it in some ways it's an excuse not to look so to look carefully at what you've done and whether you're doing and what you've done is right. So she never really looks back. She only looks forward. And you know, one of the things I feel I discovered in the reporting from my book is that she doesn't have a strategic vision. She doesn't have a way forward, a sense of where the United States should be going. She just wants to solve the problem in front of her, and that makes it very difficult to accomplish anything.
You call the book The Confidant. Are you suggesting there that Condoleezza Rice is reflecting her president in that posture?
Yes, very much so. And in fact, I argue that he is very much the idea generator in the relationship, that he's the one that...
She's the PhD, she's the scholar, but George Bush is the ideas man?
He's the ideas man, and she's translating his instincts into policy.
Let's go to Steve in Boston. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
To me, the biggest issue is and has been this war against radical Islamist fascists, whatever you want to call it, that I think that we have to do whatever it takes to win this war, because we're facing people that are trying to blow up ex-Prime Minister Bhutto with suicide bombers, or they're trying to blow us up. And you know, whether it's waterboarding or whatever tactic we need to use, we're civilization is in a fight against crazy people that are not going to give information or are not going to succumb to questioning under normal circumstances. And I don't think the world quite gets the major threat that our whole civilization, whether it's the U.S. or whether it's in Pakistan or anywhere in the world, that we're facing.
Well, Steve, does that mean all bets, all limits are off then in your mind? And if so, you know, what about the Constitution? What about the thing we're defending?
Yeah, to me, it does. And I just watched the war series on PBS where Democratic presidents, Roosevelt and Truman, did whatever it took to win that war, whether it was using nuclear weapons or firebombing cities or doing whatever it took.
Steve, we've got it. Let me take that to Margaret Tallov. Margaret, you've been on the campaign trail some. Here's a perspective, and it is out there, and it's not small. How widespread? I mean, is this what you're hearing people putting to the candidates on the campaign trail, or something else?
Well, when I go to, let's put it this way, if I go to a rally for Barack Obama, that's not what people are saying, and if I go to a rally for Fred Thompson, that is what people are saying.
Or Rudy Giuliani,
But, you know, the big question mark, and the people who aren't always at all the rallies are the people in the middle and the people who turn the election, and I think... You know, people are really divided. I mean, especially among swing voters, even though there is a real appetite to get out of the U.S. engagement in Iraq, there is not necessarily a sort of ACLU free speech welling up of, you know, like a revolution inside the country saying, that there's an absolute against the sort of surveillance and all these sort of things we're talking about. I mean, I think it's a mixed sentiment, and that's a real question mark for me in the general election. In the primary race, what you see so far has been a difference between the way Obama and Edwards are running versus the way that Hillary Clinton is running, and you see her taking a more measured centrist tack, and some of that may be the way she feels, and some of that may be looking forward and trying to understand the electorate next year.
And that's the country we live in right now. Let me take a call from Berge in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Berge, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of the show.
Thank you.
Tom, I just want to make a couple of points. Earlier in the program, you mentioned that this is a labeling resolution of the Armenian genocide.
Yes.
This description of labeling is not accurate. Basically, what it is, Tom, Raphael Lemkin, who was a lawyer of Polish Jewish descent, became interested in the Armenian genocide before World War II, of course. And his frame of mind was the Armenian experience, and he invented the word genocide to describe what had happened to the Armenians. So the word genocide existed because of Raphael Lemkin's interest in what had happened to the Armenians.
No, we understand that, and we know Hitler's reference to, you know, the assault on the Armenians and all the rest, and yet you see it sliding away in Congress. Why do you think that's happened, Berge?
Well, you see, this is where also your second point is, that is the U.S. still leading the effort in the Middle East? Is the U.S. still a superpower? You see, the U.S. Brought Turkey into NATO, built up its military, backed up its membership in the European Union, and it's also supporting it in the most favored trade status with Turkey. It is inconceivable for any ally to threaten the United States. Imagine if back in the days of West Germany, at the behest of the Germans, the United States refrained from condemning the Holocaust.
Right, but apparently not inconceivable anymore. We take your point, but Glenn Kessler, let me bring it to you. Here, Bear says, how can they do this? The U.S. should have all this leverage. But isn't this precisely one of these examples where Turkey raised a stink, brought the leverage it had to bear here, and Nancy Pelosi appears to be backing down?
This is a classic case of where, you know, this was originally started as a situation where local concerns trumped geopolitics.
That is, Armenian-American communities talking to their congresspeople.
Exactly. And this is a resolution that has come up repeatedly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and it nearly went to the floor in 2000, and at the last minute, House Speaker Hastert pulled it from the floor at the request of President Clinton because he made the same case that President Bush is making to Nancy Pelosi. This is going to mess up our relationship with Turkey, and we need Turkey.
75% of air cargo to Iraq through Turkey.
Exactly. And this is President Bush, before he became president, promised to label it as genocide. And when he became president, he got a briefing, and he realized, you know, this is going to cause me more problems than it's worth. So it's clearly, most historians would say, yes, it was genocide. There's not much debate about that. But no Democrat at this point seems to be willing to test, you know, Turkey's bluff and figure out, you know, whether or not we pass this, are they going to really make it very difficult for us?
We're looking at a week in the news. Tough comeback to Bette and the actress who glittered in Surf and Siam in the news this week. Senator Larry Craig, the Republican who won't resign over gay solicitation allegations, made his case on the Today Show.
I walked into a bathroom. I walked into an entrapment and a sting that was going on. And I go to bathrooms to use bathrooms.
The Dalai Lama's big capital appearance livened up the Beltway. And actress Deborah Carr, here in An Affair to Remember, is dead at 86.
It was nobody's fault but my own. I was looking up. It was the nearest thing to heaven. You were there.
Maybe you were, maybe you weren't. She's gone now, and many followed her career. I know Jack Beatty was there with Burt Lancaster and her in From Here to Eternity, at least in spirit. Jack Beatty's with us today. Margaret Talev of the McClatchy Newspapers is here, and Glenn Kessler, diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post, author of the new book, The Confidant, Condoleezza Rice, and the Creation of the Bush Legacy. William is calling from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. William, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great show as usual.
Thank you.
Two quick points. One on the issue of the, and I'm trying to say this where you've said it, is the rest of the world following the U.S. lead on various issues. And I believe that as we've watched nations mature and develop their own economies, their own technologies, more emphasis on human rights, I don't think we're going to see countries blindly following the U.S. anymore. And as an American, that's not what I want. I do think that the United States, on particular issues, has to make its own decisions that are in the best interest of the United States, while certainly weighing the interest of the rest of the world, and that applies to every other nation. I would also like to make one other quick point, and that is that I was kind of amused about the role of Condoleezza Rice and Bush, and I have mixed feelings about President Bush, but he's been bashed pretty well as being stupid, ignorant, blah, blah, blah.
Not today. We hear he's the ideas man today, William.
Leaders create visions, and Secretary of State follow those visions. And if that's what Condoleezza's right doing, that's right out of Management 101, Leadership 101.
William, thanks for that. Glenn Kessler, how about it? We had a couple of years ago, maybe in the last interview before his death, we had Peter Drucker on this show. And he said the biggest challenge of the next several decades is going to be the United States becoming accustomed to just being one of many powers. No longer that hyperpower that for a minute in the 1990s it looked like. William says, you know, that's okay. That's fine. Countries are growing up. Let them take care of themselves. It's an arresting point, but does the world work that way?
What I think we're seeing is that this process has been speeded up in ways that even Peter Drucker probably did not imagine.
Mm-hmm.
What has happened as the U.S. has been bogged down in Iraq is that it has opened the door for opportunities for other powers to fill the breach. You see that with Russia, buoyed by $87 a gallon oil.
Mm-hmm.
You see that with China. The president of China spent more time in Latin America last year than President Bush did, and you see it in Iran. The biggest favor that the United States has ever done for Iran is eliminate its two worst enemies, the Taliban in Afghanistan, mm-hmm, and Saddam Hussein in Iraq, and they're now out of that box. And they also see that if you want to get ahead in this world, you need to have access to nuclear technology. They're pushing ahead on that, and they're able to refuse an offer from the United States to sit down and talk to them if they would suspend their uranium enrichment because it's not worth it for them.
Margaret Taleb, is there a sense in Washington that you pick up, you know, Congress can stamp its foot, but it doesn't resound around the planet in the same way perhaps anymore? And, you know, a sense that that's okay, or a sense that that creates a kind of vacuum of leadership? I mean, after all, the U.S. has been leading one way or another for at least since the end of World War II.
Yes, I see it on two levels. On the one hand, you see Congress really doesn't have much ability to do stuff about other countries that it wants to be managing better, whether we're talking about China policy comes to mind, globalization and how it affects the U.S. economy. They've really struggled to turn their frustration in the way they want things to be, you know, into action. It's hard to control forces that are sort of larger than, you know, than one country.
Mm.
And then at the same time, because it's wartime, you see Congress having real abilities to control what the nation is doing because executive powers tend to trump in times of war, especially with this president. So on both counts, you see Congress trying to sort of, the Democratic-controlled Congress trying to send a different signal to the world about, you know, what America stands for or what a segment of American voters believe. But other than sending a message or symbols, it's very hard to put that into anything concrete.
Jack Beatty, I know you've been listening closely this week to the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, and his new Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and perhaps hearing a more sober voice there, maybe a voice that will earn more respect in time.
Well, yeah, it was one of the first press conferences I've seen, and perhaps one of the first that this team has given since General Pace just retired. And I think any American watching it and remembering the template of Don Rumsfeld and Pace would say this is an improvement. Mr. Gates is a man who takes thought, who stops and thinks. And he's not doing it in a defensive way. He's doing it empirically. What do I know and what don't I know? And he gives very careful and, in their way, suggestive answers. For example, on Iran, He said that he went through the danger of their getting nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. One, he said, would be, of course, you could have a nuclear arms race in the Middle East with Saudi Arabia following suit. And then he said, and of course, a government headed by this man with his statements about Israel is hardly a responsible party. You could hardly imagine.
That is Ahmadinejad's statement.
Yes. A government headed by that man having weapons. Well, the implication there, it seems to me, is if it weren't headed by him and by someone else, perhaps it would be more acceptable. He did not rise to the bait of the president's comment about World War III. He said, I don't interpret the president's statements. And he was just very careful and then also very respectful of reporters. He dealt with them as if they, in fact, were conduits to the public, which they are. And, of course, I just thought, oh, if only this man, this sane, careful, reasonable man, had been Secretary of Defense from the beginning rather than Captain Quig. What a situation. Things might have been different.
Donald Rumsfeld as Captain Quig. Okay. Well, I mean, he would just say it straight out, pretty much regime change. Margaret Talib, you've been on the trail following Fred Thompson and Barack Obama, and I'd love to get a little flavor of what you're seeing there. There was an interesting moment in this last week when former Senator Fred Thompson attacked Rudy Giuliani in an interview with Neil Cavuto on Fox News this week. Before the interview, Thompson spoke to a conservative group on the former mayor's home turf in New York. Let's hear it.
Some think that the best way to beat the Democrats is to be more like them. In many respects.
Well, what has he done or said that makes him more like a Democrat?
I don't think that the mayor has ever claimed to be a conservative. He sought and received the Liberal Party nomination. The Liberal Party put out a press release at the Times, as he thinks that the way we do, listed a whole host of issues. He supported a liberal Democratic gubernatorial nominee,
Mario Cuomo.
And then when Pataki was elected, opposed Pataki's tax cuts.
Fred Thompson goes after Rudy Giuliani on his conservative credentials. A Giuliani spokeswoman came out and said he can talk about labels all he wants, but labels are meaningless without results. Mayor Giuliani has done more than just talk like a conservative. He's governed like one, has the record to prove it. Margaret, you've been following Fred Thompson. Has he got his pot shotgun out here?
Well, he is trying to move ahead in the polls and solidify his position in key states where conservatism is especially important. I'm talking about South Carolina in particular. Mm-hmm. And he's, you know, he's following a strategy that makes sense to me if I were him, at least for the primary election. Rudy Giuliani doesn't have a reputation as a conservative, and yet he's been ahead in national polls and holding his own in state polls in states where you wouldn't necessarily think that he would be. So Thompson's doing what he thinks is the right thing to do in order to turn conservatives against Giuliani and turn them toward him. But the jury's still out, and Mitt Romney's complicating the picture.
Is Fred Thompson packing a punch on the campaign trail? You know, we've seen these pictures where it's kind of a yawny, sleepy, in the golf cart Fred Thompson. Is that what he continues to convey, or is that just a kind of a, I don't know, through the headlines gloss on it?
That's a really interesting question, because when I read the coverage, there's a strain of coverage about how the media is against Fred Thompson,
yeah,
or obsessed with his laziness or whatever. But when you go see him speak at an event, he will clear his throat repeatedly. It takes him a while to warm up. I don't think this is a subjective thing to say. He doesn't seem super engaged. But when you get him on a topic that he particularly cares about, whether it's federalism, states' rights, or whether it's just sort of casual conversation away from the microphone, he really lights up and he's into it and he's a different person. And I think that the challenge for him is kind of harnessing that energy and fire, you know, and, well, fire is an overstatement. He's not that kind of a guy. You know, he's not like a guy who gets sort of swept up in the moment. But there is a different energy and engagement about him when he's talking about something that he really seems schooled in and interested in. And if he could harness that and apply it more broadly to everything else, you'd see a different kind of candidacy.
Let's go to the other guy you're covering, Senator Barack Obama, campaigning in Des Moines, Iowa, this past weekend. Here's his campaign trail pitch to some African-American voters. He said President Bush was spending big money in the wrong places.
$10-12 billion every month.
That's right.
On this war.
And wow, that's a
money,
lot of money.
You know, just for next year, George Bush is asking.
Yes.
for $190 billion just for next year. That's money that could be spent on child care. It's money that could be spent on making our Medicare system better.
Margaret Taleb, how about Barack Obama? People looking at that stubborn, large gap in the polls between him and Hillary Clinton, wondering if and when and how he'll ever close it. What do you see going on out there?
Yeah, people are looking at it, and then he's looking at people who are looking at it, and then those people are bumming him out. And what I've noticed over the last couple months is sort of a dampening of his own spirit out on the campaign trail. I mean, when he is on, the guy is like on like nobody else in this race is on, you know. But the tenor of his appearances are a little bit more careful and a little bit more frustrated lately. And I think, he's telling voters stuff like it's time to decide now. You have to make a decision. You know, he's not quite as brimming with audacity, hope, and enthusiasm as he was maybe say around June. When it comes to black voters, this is really a problem for him because if he can't carry a majority of black voters, then it's going to be a problem for him in terms of staying in the game beyond Iowa or New Hampshire in these primaries that are coming up. You know, really soon. And so he has launched an effort. You see, it goes beyond Oprah's endorsement. He's doing a faith and values thing in South Carolina where his team is reaching out to black churchgoers. They're doing a series of gospel shows there next week. He taped Tavis Smiley show. He's doing a rally in East Los Angeles. But even so, the numbers haven't closed. And the question is, can he pick up more of the African American vote, and how and when?
He's trying and trying, but can he do it? There's Barack Obama. Jack Beatty, what do you make? What's the takeaway lesson for Democrats, for voters, for candidates from this very charismatic guy's trouble in closing that gap?
Well, you know, I was struck by a piece in the Times this week out of South Carolina, a small town there. And the beauty parlors are really places now where candidates look for black voters. They're gatherings. People mm-hmm. meet. They talk. And so they went around and Obama has been working the beauty parlors, and his campaign has. And they went to one of these places, and several women right out and said, "Look, we love this guy. He's terrific, but they'll kill him. He'll be killed."
In other words, somebody would assassinate
him. In other words, we
him.
Don't want that to happen to him. We want to protect him. And several people said, right on. We completely agree with that.
So protectively not supporting him, but that's a right. terrible way to have to look at things. I hope that's not widespread.
I don't know, but there's an issue there with black voters that I had no idea about. And these women were just saying, you know, we love the guy. We don't want anything to happen with him, so we're going to protect him by voting for Hillary.
Speaking of somebody who had to face that just yards from her bus, and just this week, Benazir Bhutto, of course, took it straight on. Those big blasts in Karachi, really shocking. Glenn Kessler, I want to ask you about that. Let's hear from her first. Benazir Bhutto, back in Pakistan after 8 years in exile, had this to say about the Thursday attack on her caravan in Karachi.
As the sun set, we saw that the street lights had been closed. And while I am not blaming the government for the suicide attacks on me, and while I'm not blaming the government for the assassination attacks on me at this stage, nonetheless, we need to have an inquiry as to why the street lights had been shut.
Glenn Kessler, you're our diplomatic correspondent here. In some ways, we're not shocked, and still it's shocking. More than 100 dead, 450 wounded. This is a huge attack, and she'd only been home for hours. What does this say?
Well, this is a huge problem for the Bush administration. Pakistan is in many ways the most dangerous place on earth today. And the administration has backed Pervez Musharraf, the general who took power in a coup, from the beginning, even though he has very limited democratic credentials. And they've kind of winked the other way, even though they claim to promote democracy around the world. They spent months trying to engineer this power-sharing agreement between Bhutto and Musharraf. And it's kind of a tawdry little deal which keeps him in power and
corruption makes, charges against her go away.
Right. Not the most auspicious beginning to bring democracy.
But here's my question. Part of that deal, or the sort of bigger deal, grand deal here is that he gets another 5 years in the presidency. Now mm-hmm. she's home, and on day one, two big bombs near her. I mean, can Benazir Bhutto hang in there in Pakistan in that kind of environment for 5 years waiting for a chance at leadership?
Well, she would run in, her party would run in the parliamentary elections. But yes, it's very problematic, and it just it rips at the fabric of this country. That Musharraf has been nearly killed himself on a number of occasions. Mm-hmm. I mean, his government
no stranger to assassination attempts.
Right, and it shows how this happened at Karachi, which is far from the capital. In some ways, you could say that Musharraf is basically the mayor of Islamabad. He doesn't have that much control over the rest of the country.
Can the United States help out Bhutto?
Well, not in a way that is substantial. We certainly can't provide for her security in a way that, you know, would ensure she would not be killed.
Well, and there goes the world again. Glenn Kessler, diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post, it's been great having you today. Glenn's new book is The Confidant, Condoleezza Rice and the Creation of the Bush Legacy, and perhaps we're seeing it. Glenn, thank you very much for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
Margaret Tolov, national political correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Margaret, always wonderful to have you. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thanks. It was fun.
Jack Beattie, have a good weekend, my friend. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.